You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of October, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Rachel Shabby, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Rachel, what are we looking at today?
We're looking at the bloody stalemate in Egypt, who wears the jeans in the Middle East, and why the death of a leading rabbi is so mourned in Israel.
Also, who will replace Karzai? There's been a last-minute rush of nominations in the Afghan presidential race. We'll get some expert analysis on the candidates and the possible outcome.
Also on the program, we're going to be slipping on our deck shoes, donning our striped cardigans, and we're going to be heading out to sea.
The Italians are the benchmark. Everybody is setting their boats up against. And so we want to be part of this family. We want to be recognized as one of the leading powerboat manufacturers.
Those items all to come, and we'll be playing you some geographically appropriate music in the next hour here on Midori House.
So lots to come in a Tuesday edition of Midori House here on Monocle 24, but before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
The world's first vaccine against malaria is to be submitted for regulatory approval. It follows research suggesting that it's halved cases of malaria among young children in trials. Hundreds of thousands of people are still killed by malaria every year. The British company GlaxoSmithKline says it's hoping the drug could be in use as early as 2015. The US government is continuing to defend the Special Forces raid in which a suspected al-Qaeda leader was seized. Abu Anas al-Libi is being interrogated on a US Navy ship in the Mediterranean. He's suspected over a series of attacks, including the bombing of two US embassies in Africa 15 years ago. Libya remains angry over the raid on its territory. Monocle's Navina Cotter is in neighboring Tunisia.
The Libyan government was not very happy. They said they were going to raise and protest the capture of al-Qaeda leader Anas al-Libi with the U.S. government in Washington, and that they preferred and they're very keen to prosecute any Libyan citizens inside Libya.
232 people are now known to have died when a boat carrying African migrants sank off the Italian island of Lampedusa last week. Divers have recovered dozens more bodies, but a large number of people are still missing after the boat caught fire and sank. 155 people were rescued. There have been clashes in two Brazilian cities between police and protesters demanding better pay for teachers. More than 10,000 people joined a demonstration in Rio, which turned violent after dark, with firebombs thrown at public buildings. A similar protest in Sao Paulo also ended in violence, with banks ransacked. President Obama has signaled he's prepared to accept a short-term move to stop the U.S. government running out of money. The debt ceiling must be raised within 10 days, but there's still no deal on the U.S. budget. A week into a partial federal government shutdown, which has forced hundreds of thousands of people to take unpaid leave. Just weeks after taking office, Australia's new Prime Minister is facing questions over his expenses claims. Tony Abbott has already repaid money he claimed for attending colleagues' weddings, but he's resisting calls to hand back cash claimed for taking part in a sporting event. Fran Kelly from Australia's ABC says Mr. Abbott has insisted it was a politically motivated triathlon.
The Ironman contest at Port Macquarie. Now, Tony Abbott's answer to that is, well, Port Macquarie is a marginal electorate, and he was doing a lot of other things up there, not just running the Ironman contest, but that's kind of a bad look for him.
The Maldives Supreme Court has annulled the results of the first round of voting in the country's presidential election. After allegations of fraud, it's ordered the vote is rerun later this month. Mohamed Nasheed, who was forced from office in an alleged coup last year, won almost half of the votes. The candidate placed third had asked the court to order a fresh poll. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much to Paul Osborne. It's now 4 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong, Zurich,
London,
Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Monocle 24.
From London,
London, London,
Caracas. De Londres.
This is Monocle 24. Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from a Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin. The time is 8:05 here in London. It's time now, though, to set the day's news agenda with the three key stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Rachel Shabi, a journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. We're going to be taking a look at some of the top stories from the Middle East. Welcome to the program, Rachel. Shall we begin with Egypt? Obviously, over the weekend, deadly protest. It was meant to be a celebration for the 40th anniversary of the war, a celebration of the military, but of course things turned rather violent and deadly in Egypt. What's going to come next for the country? It seems like it's spiraling out of control in a sense.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as you say, the demonstrations that were supposed to commemorate the 40-year anniversary of the Arab-Israeli 73 war with Israel rapidly deteriorated into violence when Muslim Brotherhood and their supporters decided that that would be a good time, for some reason, to reassert opposition to the military and the transitional government that followed the coup and the ouster of their democratically elected Islamist president. So in that context, of course, there was a bloody showdown on Sunday. And yesterday we saw sort of reprisal attacks against police and security forces, car bombings and drive-by shootings. So we have a situation that, again, is deadlocked in a very bloody way. It seems like there is no way out. And it seems like the violence is really taking over all areas of Egypt.
Is Tunisia a possible model for the way forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting contrast looking at Tunisia, because they there, and no doubt looking at the situation in Egypt and inspired and informed by that, the Islamist-led coalition there, in Ennahda, has decided to step down in the face of opposition. The last year has been quite difficult for Tunisia, not as difficult as Egypt, but the same sort of problems have arisen, the sort of clash between secularists and Islamists over what kind of political identity would be forged in this country post-revolution. And as a solution to that, the Islamist party, Ennahda, said, OK, then we will step down. And it has just approved a roadmap. So all parties have approved this roadmap, which is the next step. What happens next in Tunisia? Transitional government, a technical assembly to decide on the constitution. Now, that, of course, seems like a much better way out than the kind of stalemate and deadly stalemate that we're seeing in Egypt.
And of course, that was a political solution in Tunisia.
Exactly.
It was not a military solution, as is the case in Egypt, when the military overthrew the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamist government there.
Exactly. And that's what a lot of commentators have been saying, you know, the what ifs. What if instead of removing the government by coup, the Egyptian population had just demanded that a re-election, and then presumably the Muslim Brotherhood would have hemorrhaged all their support in a political election, and then would have been removed with a sort of credibility and political transparency that would have resulted in a far better transition than the one we're seeing now.
Because, of course, we've seen people power there before. They've brought down two presidents, several governments. I mean, is there a real chance, do you think, for people power to fix it?
Well, people power didn't fix it. I mean, people power is what brought the coup. People power is what inspired the military to think that they had a mandate to remove the president. So I'm not sure, like, now that we see the people power in Egypt is firmly behind a military takeover, and they fully endorse the actions of the military. And that's exactly the trouble, because, you know, as some commentators have said, you know, it's not like you can wave your magic wand and disappear the Muslim Brotherhood. They still have a huge swathe of support.
And General Abdel Sisi has taken a very hard line against the Muslim Brotherhood. Do you think there's any prospect that they could perhaps be brought back into the fold in some form or another? Not perhaps in the form that we know today as the Muslim Brotherhood, but perhaps in another element or shape or size?
It's hard to see how they will make a comeback. I mean, the military seems very determined to eliminate them from political and public life. And they do seem to have public support for that. So we've seen not only that the organization has been banned, but now there's been a decree saying, well, we don't really like Muslim Brotherhood-led mosques either. And of course, mosques have been the bedrock of Brotherhood organization, both socially and politically. So it seems like everything is moving in the direction of eliminating this group.
But then surely that just brings them underground, and that risks the radicalization of these individuals.
Well, that's why, you know, some people are saying that's exactly why we're seeing the kind of violence that we're seeing against the security forces in Egypt today. Now, of course, the Brotherhood has consistently publicly denounced that violence. But if Islamists that are or aren't affiliated to the Brotherhood don't see a political solution, they are going to resort to other means.
Rachel, I want to move on now to Iran and denims. This is a story obviously coming out of there. Give us a roundup of where things stand there.
Well, Iranians have basically hit back at the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, who the other day, you know, this is in the sort of the latest round of exchanges between Iran and Israel. Iran has this kind of new era of diplomacy, smile bombing, as Israel has described it, to which the Israelis haven't smiled back, which would be the sort of diplomatic response, but instead scowled and frowned and hurled abuses. And part of that is Netanyahu criticizing the Iranians for being undemocratic and, you know, not being able to wear jeans and not listening to Western music. And this has prompted this kind of meme explosion from Iran, a Twitter frenzy with Iranians sending pictures of their piles of jeans, the Western music that they listen to, various pictures of Iranians in the street wearing jeans, basically ridiculing Netanyahu for being so out of touch as to not realize what people are doing in Iran, and also suggesting, look, if you don't even know that we wear jeans, how are you supposed to have any credibility over our nuclear capacity and plans for that?
It's interesting, though, to watch, because it does seem like the Israelis are losing the PR battle with Rouhani. Is that the case?
It seems to be. I mean, it seems that Israel is really isolating itself with this tactic. This is a historic moment. The last week was a massive breakthrough in the Middle East. Those of us who sort of watch it for a long time do so weary-eyed and with a lot of cynicism. But all that vanished last week with this hope in the kind of the thawing of relations between Iran and the states, the possibility that Iran might come in from the cold, the possibility that it might see the end of a very brutal and punishing economic sanctions on the country, that it could come back into the sort of economic fold as much as anything else. And in the face of that, we have Netanyahu and Israel saying, well, you know, these guys, Rouhani is a wolf in sheep's clothing. He doesn't mean it. Everything's the same. And we need to watch out. And he is the only one saying that, or rather Israel is the only nation saying that. So it does seem a little bit out of touch at the moment. Yeah.
Can Israel, is there any possibility that Israel could actually prevent a deal with America?
No, it couldn't prevent a deal. But it could. The only way that Israel could botch this is to take unilateral military action, which of course it has threatened to do, and it has done for the past few years. It has said, look, if we don't have international support, particularly if we don't have US support, we will go it alone. However, that's what's coming out of Netanyahu's mouth. Military chiefs in Israel are saying something very different. They're saying the opposite. They're saying that would be disastrous, a really bad move, and we don't endorse it. So even on those terms, it seems like Netanyahu really is on his own.
And finally, Rachel, Jerusalem, let's stay in Israel. Jerusalem has seen its biggest ever funeral, more than 700,000 mourners attending the death of an ultra-Orthodox rabbi, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef.
Yeah, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, Abdullah Yusuf, as he was known in Iraq, where he was born, was the spiritual leader of Jews from the Middle East in Israel, but also, you know, a political component with the religious party Shas, which was set up in the 80s and has since then been the kind of kingmaker in any coalition government in Israel. So he's massively popular, not just as a sort of leading rabbinical figure, which a lot of people respect him for, but also for kind of bringing back a kind of dignity to Middle Eastern Jews who historically were discriminated and their culture kind of denigrated in Israel. Shas was one of the movements that tried to fight against that, to restore kind of dignity and to mention the discrimination that Israeli society was practicing, but at the same time denying. So he has a massive following because of that. And that partly explains why his death is so mourned.
Rachel, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for coming on. Rachel's a journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be finding out what man looks set to lead Afghanistan after Hamid Karzai steps down in 2014. That's all after this very short break.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
You can't really create 240 years of a story. What I'm saying is the brand has incredible authenticity and creates integrity.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time in association with Lexus.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 11:17 in Moscow. It's 8:17 here in London, and very early in the morning in Washington, D.C., just 3:17 a.m. Now, it is potentially one of the most important elections on the global stage next year. The man who will replace Hamid Karzai as the next president of Afghanistan.
Nominations for president closed over the weekend ahead of April's vote, and a total of 22 candidates are on the ballot. There are, however, only really six serious candidates that have a shot at winning. The men include a former mentor to 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, former warlords, and the 2009 runner-up. Joining us now on the line is Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute and Rod Norland, the Afghanistan bureau chief for the New York Times. Shashank, we'll speak to you in a moment, but first, Rod, let's turn to you. We've seen a rush of late entries to the presidential race, including Hamid Karzai's brother. Is he a serious contender?
He's a serious contender. It remains to be seen if he's going to have some backing and support from his brother. Publicly, the president has let it be known that he didn't want his brother to run, and there's been a lot of enmity between the Karzai brothers, both Qayyum and others as well. And so he's a serious candidate, as serious as anybody else is, yes.
And is it really the man that needs to be beaten is Abdullah Abdullah, the 2009 runner-up?
That's right, yes. And he'll be a very strong contender, but I think the candidate to be beaten will be the one that President Karzai throws his weight behind and the apparatus of government, although he's pledged not to do that. I don't think anybody seriously believes that. And most betting now is that person will be the former foreign minister, Rasool. A lot of people around the president have let it be known that that's the person he backs. So that'll be the person to beat.
So Russell's a descendant of Afghanistan's royal family. He turned to a former warlord lord clan for one of his running mates to build support. But historically, he also has a woman as a running mate, Habiba Sarobi.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he's the only one. That's the only woman in the race, and that certainly won't, women do get the vote here, and they vote in fairly large numbers. There's big efforts made to enable women voting, so that's certainly not going to hurt him any.
Rod Norland, we're going to have to leave it there. The Afghanistan bureau chief for the New York Times. Let's move our attention now to Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute. Shashank, we were hearing a bit about some of the potential candidates for 2014. What's your take on next year's elections?
Well, the big concern is that if this goes wrong, everything goes wrong. And the reason is Afghanistan is containing the levels of violence right now, and it can keep containing them as long as we see continued billions of dollars pour in from international donors to support the Afghan National Security Forces. Now, that's about $4 to $6 billion per year. And the U.S. Congress, as we know, is not in the mood to shell out this cash when you have President Karzai, amongst other things in his interview yesterday, saying NATO has caused great suffering in his country. So if this election looks like the last one, if it looks fraudulent, if it looks stolen, if it looks like there's a close race and one side refuses to back down, that cash is at risk because no one is going to fund an Afghan state where the president may have won by fraud or force or anything like that.
Well, the current administration, as we know, is rife with corruption. So who would be in the best position to deal with that of those likely candidates?
Well, the short and cynical answer is probably none of them. And indeed, if the candidate in question wins by virtue of enjoying the benefit of Karzai's patronage networks built up over 10 years, the ability to mobilize the state to push people to the ballot box, to secure votes, to give funding out to favored candidates, we'll probably see more of the same. And there's nothing to suggest any of these candidates are great reformers. I mean, of course, some of them are ostensibly technocrats, people like Ashraf Ghani, who was a very senior member of Mr. Karzai's government and a very well-known technocrat, one of those candidates who's very well liked in the West, mostly for fairly superficial reasons, I would suggest. But there's nothing to say that they would necessarily clean up the Afghan state. And indeed, they would be seen as relatively weak leaders who wouldn't command the support of all segments within Afghan society. So I think the really big concern here is not who wins, but how they win, and making sure that if there is any fraud, we don't brush it under the carpet like we did last time, and it's actually held up to a little more scrutiny.
And just this very week, Norway decided that it was going to cut some of its aid program because Afghanistan wasn't doing enough to deal with corruption. Both the UN and the EU need to sign new agreements next year. Do we know what the Obama administration is hoping for in this? Who are they perhaps rooting for in next year's election? Do we know any of that yet?
Well, I think there's some, we don't know. I mean, we can only speculate. They would probably be more comfortable with a technocratic figure like Ashraf Ghani, probably less comfortable with a former Islamist, a little more uncomfortable with a former warlord in that sense. But the overarching principle for the Americans here is, in some ways, anyone but Karzai. Karzai has been a thorn in their side. It's been incredibly difficult negotiating the so-called bilateral security agreement with him, and each side has been playing chicken. The Americans have said, we will leave no troops in Afghanistan after next year, you will be on your own, implicitly saying you can go hang from a lamppost like the other Afghan presidents in the past. And Karzai saying, no, we won't let you keep anyone in Afghanistan, we don't want you, we don't need you, we'll cancel talks here unless you give us very favorable terms. So in a way, what the Americans want, I think, is a fair, clean election that sees a stable government and someone who will negotiate with them. And it matters less who it is than it's someone who is amenable to at least dealing with them in a more stable way than Karzai has done.
I guess it is going to be wait and see for next year's election. Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute, thanks very much for joining us on the program. And before that, we were speaking to Rod Norland, the New York Bureau Chief, New York Times Bureau Chief in Kabul.
It's 11:23 in Dubai, 9:23 in Paris and 8:23 here in London. And it's to Paris that we return to speak to our man there, Tom Burgess-Watson, for a check-in of the latest French news. Hi, Tom.
Good morning to you both.
Tom, we're looking at Sarkozy and it seems like he's off the hook in his long-running legal drama. And, of course, that means that the way is now cleared for him to run in the 2017 presidential race.
Absolutely. Last time we spoke a few weeks ago, it was certainly looking as though Sarkozy's political future was in jeopardy. And as you say, he's now absolutely clear to run for president again in 2017, because he's been under investigation now for about 7 months, since March, in fact, when he was investigated for illegal campaign financing. That was back in 2007, when it's alleged that he received funds from Liliane Bettencourt, and she is France's richest woman. She's the heiress of L'Oréal. And it's alleged, according to her butler and various members of her staff, that Sarkozy frequently visited her and received envelopes stuffed with cash for his campaign in 2007, which, of course, was a successful campaign because he went on to become president. And it's alleged that he received, according to her staff, 4 million euros. But doctors weighed in a couple of weeks ago. There was testimony a few weeks ago from the medical sources saying she was too frail. She didn't know what she was doing, and therefore he was taking advantage of an elderly woman with lots of money who didn't know which way was up, basically. And in short, he risked a jail term, he risked a huge fine, and a 5-year ban from political life, which would have delighted his opponents in the political world, because it would have meant he couldn't stand for president in elections in 4 years from now. But now it looks as though he can run, as you said. And quite frankly, if he did run, even tomorrow, according to the opinion polls, he'd win hands down against François Hollande, the president, who he lost to just last year.
But the judges actually haven't said that they don't think Bettencourt's money was illegally solicited for his campaign, just that there's no proof, actually, that Sarkozy himself pressured her into giving it. And I mean, there are other charges that people want him to answer. The whole kickback from Pakistan, the Karachi affair, the business with Bernard Tapie.
Absolutely. There are other cases which are entirely separate from this one, not least what's called the affaire Tapie, as you mentioned there, the former owner of Adidas, who it's alleged was given preferential treatment in a tribunal but shortly after his election back in 2007. So he's not off the hook in every respect, but certainly this case had been a major thorn in his side, the Bettencourt case. And that was the one that was looking like preventing him from running in 2017. Now, whether or not other cases end up preventing him from ever running in that election in 4 years from now remains to be seen. But certainly this one is clear now. There are still some questions hanging over the campaigning financing, but it doesn't necessarily involve him. It's more the treasurer of his campaign back in 2007, Eric Woerth, who will have to answer in court to those two questions about just who took what amount of money. But certainly Sarkozy must be delighted at the result of yesterday's decision that investigations be dropped on this particular case.
Tom, let's move on to another topic which you've highlighted for us. Could I expect to see you strolling down the Champs-Élysées on a Sunday afternoon, perhaps doing a spot of shopping?
Yes, well, I would like to be wandering down the Champs-Élysées on a Sunday afternoon doing some shopping because, quite frankly, there are very few shops open here in Paris and on a Sunday or indeed late in the evenings. And this is because there's been a huge debate these last few weeks. There's been lawsuits, there's been the unions making a big stand against shops that do open on a Sunday. Now, the perfumery and cosmetic firm Sephora has a huge flagship store on the Champs-Élysées, and it used to be open until quite late at night, and now they're having to close at 9 p.m., which is a big setback for that shop because a series of court rulings recently have upheld bans on both late-night shopping and Sunday openings, and it applies to all non-food retailers. So unless you're selling slices of meat, you may not open on a Sunday. And even then, you're only able to open until lunchtime.
But as far as the argument about boosting the economy goes, if you keep the shops open longer, you'll make more money. Surely, if you want to buy something, you're going to buy it. You'll just wait till the shops are open.
Well, not necessarily, because a lot of people, and including people in our profession, work shifts. And we might be having our day off on a totally different day from the rest of the country. It's not necessarily the case that people are only able to go off on a shopping trip on a Sunday only. And I don't know if you remember, but back in the UK there was a similar scenario in the mid 90s. This huge debate. Should Sunday trading happen or not? It feels like a very long time ago. In fact, it was only 15 or so years ago that Sunday trading became legal in Britain. And here, the unions, and oddly enough, the church have a huge say in this one, which is quite ironic because France is, of course, a secular country, and these antique laws about not opening on a Sunday date back centuries. And if you're a student, for example, who wants to work on a Sunday, as a lot of students do, because it's a very convenient day off of the week to work, and up until now, as a student working on a Sunday, you've earned 50% more. So it's been very attractive. But now they've come down pretty hard against retailers, and that's gonna have a big effect on their earning capability, because Sunday is a big day for shops to earn, especially from tourists who are visiting. And now what tourists are doing, they're just getting on the Eurostar and going to London to do their shopping there instead.
Well, I was just going to say, Tom, if you ever want to come for an afternoon of shopping in London on a Sunday, I'll get you a Eurostar ticket and we can have a fun little time over on Oxford Street. Why not? Tom Burgess Watson, our man in Paris, many thanks for joining us.
In the next half an hour of the programme, we'll discover the latest luxury super yacht. We'll read the Italian press and we'll meet some of the world's leading graphic artists from Alliance Graphic International.
I think it's actually a golden period, and I think that more work has been made, there's more bad work has been made, but there's also more good work, and the good work is really pushing boundaries and really challenging us.
But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
A drug company has announced it's to seek regulatory approval for the first ever vaccine against malaria. It's after trials which suggest it has cut the number of cases among young children by around half. Malaria still kills hundreds of thousands of people every year. If approved, the new drug could be in use within 2 years. The suspected Al-Qaeda leader seized by US Special Forces in Libya is being questioned by an elite interrogation team. Abu Anas al-Libi is suspected over a series of attacks, including the bombing of two US embassies in Africa 15 years ago, but Libya is still demanding an explanation of the operation to capture him in their country. It's now thought at least 232 people died when a boat carrying hundreds of African migrants sank close to an Italian island. Divers off the island of Lampedusa found dozens more bodies last night, but more than 100 people are still missing. There have been violent protests in two Brazilian cities during demonstrations in support of higher pay for teachers. In Rio, firebombs were thrown at public buildings and a bus was set on fire. Police responded with tear gas. There was also violence in Sao Paulo. And President Obama has said that he could accept a short-term solution to stop the US government running out of cash during the federal government shutdown. An even bigger crisis is approaching if America's debt ceiling can't be raised within 10 days. It's now more than a week since the dispute over a new budget, which forced hundreds of thousands of federal workers to take unpaid leave. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Paul. He'll be back at the top of the hour with more news. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and Phil Hahn. Now, graphic designers from across the world gathered in London last month for the RG London Open. Typographers, book designers and graphic artists from the music and film industries descended on the city's Barbican Centre to gauge the temperature of graphic design today.
RG, or the Alliance Graphique Internationale, was founded in 1954 as a forum for the world's leading graphic artists. Membership is by invitation only, and those who make up the organization today work in all branches of graphic design all over the world. Well, Monocle's Thomas Lewis headed down to see what it was all about for this week's edition of Section D.
Here at the RG Open in London, graphic designers from across the spectrum have gathered to discuss the industry today. There are 2,000 young designers here who, on day two of the event, are posed a question by some of the veterans of graphic design. Do you read or can you draw?
I mean, the question was if I was going to hire someone and, you know, one of them can't draw and one of them doesn't read or doesn't like to read, well, you know, I wouldn't hire either of them, quite frankly.
Marian Banches is a graphic artist from Vancouver who specializes in typography.
I mean, as a life skill, obviously, reading is more important. Reading's very important, but I love people who can draw, and people who can draw really well astonish me.
But it's a question of imagination, the bread and butter of any graphic designer, that's at the root of the drawing versus reading debate, the panellists say. For Michael Dempsey, a veteran graphic designer for the British opera and film industries, it's a useful question, but perhaps an artificial one.
Graphic design is, there's no right way and there's no wrong way anymore. There's just a way, and you have to find the way that you like.
Dempsey was responsible for the redesign of London's English National Opera Company and designed the opening sequences for the movies of British film director David Hare.
Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself.
Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
He says the approach for young designers entering the field today should be a fairly simple one.
I approach everything in the same way, in that I read, do a bit of research, and then just think. And a lot of my thinking often is done on the top of a bus. You know, it's the best place.
The speakers here at the two-day event represent most of the branches of graphic design. Typographers, poster and book designers, and creatives from the magazine and film industries are all here. Events like this one are designed to give those starting out in the industry a toehold in an increasingly shifting field. The digitization of the design industry has had two key effects on graphic design. These are different days to those of the Letraset typeface system, developed in the 1960s. Its bold, austere lettering forms a large part of the work of Andrew Stevens, of the Graphic Thought Facility, who worked on the graphic design of London's Olympic Park.
It's always been an important part of the makeup that got me into graphic design, and so I always had a strong affection for it and its iconography. In a way, having those boundaries to push against is always a great start for a designer, because you're within a set vocabulary, you've got to kind of react with it and use it as the tool to get somewhere else.
Digital design may have democratized the industry. Anyone, anywhere can now pretty much design something and share it online. But it's also, in many ways, saturated the design landscape. As Tony Brook, graphic designer and UK president of ARGY, tells me.
Well, there are always things to be concerned about. You're always driving to be better, but it's in fantastically rude health. I think it's actually a golden period. And I think that, personally, I think that computers have had a huge hand in that. That more work has been made, there's more bad work has been made, but there's also more good work, and the good work is really pushing boundaries and really challenging us. And so I think we're in a very, very good situation right here, right now.
Graphic design might be becoming a more competitive field, but those commissioning work are also getting more choosy. Marian Banches again.
7-8 years ago, I was really sticking out for doing something new, and then, you know, a lot of people started doing similar things, and I'm sort of constantly moving myself ahead. I'm constantly changing my work. Quite frankly, they don't have the awe for the work that they used to have, and so they're more difficult to please.
Everything from typeface to the design of book covers and LP sleeves are up for grabs here.
So how does jazz, typography and graphic design combine into this, you know, obsession? How many people, show hands, has today in their home a record, an LP, a vinyl record?
The mood here in London is upbeat, but there is a very quiet sense of nervousness here too.
To see 2,000 young designers is fantastic. My only worry is that because it is such a big industry and there are not enough spaces within that industry, what are they all going to end up doing? You know, I think having a creative education is great because they can take that anywhere, you know, end up in whatever sphere, and it'll be useful. Better than, you know, all those people sitting in the city pushing numbers around. I'd much prefer to hang out with creative people every time.
And those creatives have another, more pressing question to pose the 2,000 young designers here as the conference draws to a close.
One last question before we close. This is anonymous. How important are jazzy socks to the design process?
The industry might be filling up, but the advice is clear. Get a pen, a book, and a pair of jazzy socks, and you're ready to make your way in graphic design. Paint me a picture. For Monocle, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Paint me a picture.
I think I'd love to see Thomas Lewis in a pair of jazzy socks. He is one versatile producer.
Yeah, he certainly
does a lot.
Is. Yeah, and a very good sailor, I'm told.
Sailor? Mm-hmm. Well, that's what's going to happen next, isn't it?
Exactly.
I've got my boat shoes, do you?
Uh-huh. I know, I do, totally.
You're not
wearing them
now,
have my sea legs, though, I believe.
Well,
we'll get them
in a couple of minutes. But you can hear more on that program, of course, with Thomas Lewis. That, of course, is our weekly design show, Section D. And the latest edition premieres tonight at 1900 hours London time.
Well, as you know, in our next section, we're all out at sea.
To report on the world, you need reporters around the world. With Bureau in Hong Kong and Tokyo, New York and Toronto, Zurich and, up next, Istanbul, Monocle 24 has a growing network of editors and correspondents. In Tokyo, Fiona Wilson.
From the Tokyo office, we cover everything from politics and business to architecture and design. We might be reporting on Shinzo Abe's radical economic policies or territorial tensions in the Senkaku Islands, as well as breaking news from around the region.
In Hong Kong, Aisha Spears.
From Monocle's Hong Kong office, we take stock of much of the Asia-Pacific region. We're watching everything from Xi Jinping's changing China to the Southeast Asian economies that are fast becoming hubs for young, creative business.
In New York, Santiago Rodriguez-Tarditi.
From the New York Bureau, we cover the latest in food, travel and hospitality trends while keeping an eye on the business developments and political happenings in the US and the rest of the Americas.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:41 here in London. Now, while most of us have said goodbye to summer and swapped our swimsuits for warmer attire...
No!
I'm afraid so.
That's sad.
Shivering here in our jackets. However, boat builders in Europe are already gearing up for next year's holiday season on the Mediterranean. This past month has seen shipyards, big and small, showing off the latest luxury super yachts and weekend sailboats in Cannes and Monaco to tempt the seafaring public.
Well, this week it was Italy's turn as the nation's yacht makers unveiled new models at the annual Genoa Boat Show. The event was a downsized version compared to previous editions given the rough economic seas Italy finds itself in, but the sector is hoping for a bit of relief by luring buyers from abroad. Well, Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho paid a visit pierside at Genoa to learn more.
In 2008, Italy's yacht building industry, the world's biggest, was riding a wave of prosperity with over 6 billion euros in orders. But 5 years after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the sector still faces headwinds. 20,000 jobs have been shed and sales are down 60%, as people prefer to charter yachts or buy second-hand. Yet some believe the worst is now behind them. Stefano Campanelli, sales director at the Ferretti Group.
We see some light at the end of the tunnel. And we have restarted selling boats, even boats of a certain importance in terms of feet, of footage, of length, and so all this is really encouraging for the company, for our group.
Now, where do you see growth today with Europe still in a delicate situation? Are those emerging markets getting more and more important?
We are opening the greater China market through a number of showrooms, new offices, because we are confident that the Chinese market represents an opportunity, a big challenge for our group.
One of the country's biggest producers, with brands that include classic runabouts made by Riva, Ferretti has righted itself after being bought by a Chinese industrial group last year. The company is going after newly minted millionaires from Istanbul to Hong Kong, eager to get their hands on tailor-made Italian luxury yachts.
We are in a position to adapt the product within a certain limit to the local demands. It's easy to understand that the expectations of a Chinese customer are not the same of an Italian customer, are not the same of an American customer. So just to give you an example, when we sell a boat in China, according to our first experiences. Most of our boat owners demand to dismantle a cabin and to turn it into a karaoke room, because for them the boat is a business tool at the time being, which is not the case in Italy, for instance. So this is an example of a very peculiar request that we are able to satisfy.
So they like to have business meetings with a karaoke bar?
They like to have business meetings. The boat is, in their mentality, according to their mindset, a status symbol.
The majority of the 750 exhibitors were pushing powerboats on prospective owners. But there were still plenty of classic sailboats, many now easier to navigate, less costly, and outfitted with fancier quarters, including oak cabinets and kitchen countertops in Corian. Ruggero Gandolfi is managing director at Gran Soleil.
We are here now on our last model, our 43. Nowadays, sailing is day by day more a pleasure and can be afforded by new entry guys that are not boating, but they would start the experience, feeling the elements, feeling the sea, feeling the wind, of course with a lower price than in respect of power boats. Sailing is not impossible as maybe it was years and years ago, because now the boats are very easy handling. Everything can be done by some good electric winch. Of course, today there is a lot of people are talking about being green, and about on the seaside, being green means 100% to sail. But we should even think that running costs on a sailboat are much lower, because you need less maintenance, of course you need less fuel, and so you can really cruise for a long while without caring about the fact that it's costing a fortune.
Foreign builders were also in attendance, keen to compete on Italian soil for orders in the all-important Mediterranean market. Based on a lake in the Austrian Alps, family-run Frauscher makes powerboats for day cruising. Florian Helmberger is the company's sales manager.
It's a completely different design philosophy. So with Frauscher, we try to pull back everything you don't need in a boat. So our boats are basically high performance on a very, very clean level, like modern architecture, for example, with the straight bow design, clean surfaces, no frills, but still all the details are made in the highest possible quality.
Now, how important is it to be in Genoa?
For us, it's very important, because basically the Italians are the benchmark everybody is setting their boats up against, and so we want to be part of this family. We want to be recognized as one of the leading powerboat manufacturers.
Do you see the European market coming back?
Yeah, we already see coming back slowly, though. We see a lot of growth from Middle East, so we have lots of new customers from Saudi Arabia, from Dubai, and we are picking up some sales from Australia even, but the main market is still in Europe.
After 5 days of courting customers, talk at Genoa hinted at an industry poised for a rebound. Orders trickled in to give hope that boatyards won't be idle this winter in the run-up to next year's summer cruising season. For Monocle, in Genoa, I'm Ivan Carvalho.
Welcome back to Midori House. Well, in a moment, we'll be leafing through the Italian front pages. But ahead of that, it's time for a song. This is Aspettare Aspettaro by the Milanese band Amari. Aspetto l'alba per partire, stare svegli. And And that was the Italian band Amari with Aspettare Aspettero. Now, we've been having an argument in the studio.
Your Italian's very good, Georgina.
Not impressed. Good enough to tell you definitely what that means, because wait, wait, or expect, I'm expecting. The man who can tell us, of course, is right here. David Pleasance.
Hello, Georgina and Phil.
So good we introduced him twice. David, of course, is our British-Italian researcher. He's joined us in the studio with a stack of papers from Italy. But before we get onto them, what does that song mean?
To wait, I will wait. Wait, I'll wait.
I'll wait, right?
Yeah, aspettare, aspettero. Is
our,
that the title?
Our producer, Daphne Dennis, thought it said, I'll expect.
I believe it's I wait, wait. Okay.
And she's telling me that's a lie now.
Anyway, enough waiting for us. Let's get straight on to those Italian papers. What have you got for us, David?
So quite a business focus for you today. I thought we'd start with a big story on pretty much all of the papers. This is the ongoing trouble with Alitalia, the flag carrier of Italy. The La Repubblica on their front page has black smoke from the Alitalia talks that are going on. Black smoke, that kind of Vatican reference. Obviously meaning no decision. They're waiting for the white smoke to signify that the talks that have been happening in a ministry building over the funding of the struggling airline have come to any kind of conclusion, and they haven't, sadly. One interesting development has been the potential involvement of Ferrovie dello Stato, the FS, the Italian State Railways. They have not denied that they have interest in perhaps getting involved in saving the struggling airline. So that's quite an interesting development in terms of transport.
Air France, KLM currently have a 25% stake in Alitalia. Many analysts saying that a merger with Air France, KLM would be the best option, the most realistic option. Is that something that the Italians are willing to do?
Well, I think that there's kind of two camps on that. There's a kind of there's the camp that wants to keep Alitalia very much in Italian hands, going back to the previous government's efforts to try and get Italian businesses involved in salvaging the airline. That doesn't seem to have worked. Air France, KLM don't seem keen on investing any more money in Alitalia. They're struggling themselves. They have a huge debt. The Franco-Dutch airline have a huge debt themselves. So it doesn't seem likely that the amount of funding that Alitalia needs is going to come from that kind of partnership.
And there's a lot of concern, isn't there, that if that happened, there would be very tough conditions and a lot of job losses.
Exactly. And the job losses has always been a key part of that. And in fact, Confindustria, the main trade union involved, the head of that, Giorgio Squinzi, today has said that perhaps, and this is rather defeatist statement, rather sad statement from the head of the union, perhaps Italy is not quite big enough to actually have a global airline at all. So that's just kind of expressing the doubts over the survival of this national.
The figures are really quite startling. Something like £680 million debts, a billion euros it's lost since 2009, when it was rescued by a group of Italian investors, as well as Air France. So perhaps that's the right argument. They just can't perhaps compete on a global scale.
Well, that's right. But then how else can they compete? And that's the real question. Because on the European level, obviously, the budget airlines and other rivals really have kind of taken the rug from underneath the carpet from underneath Alitalia, and they were trying to position themselves as an intercontinental alternative, offering new routes to Asia and the Americas. But perhaps they're not able to actually put the money in behind those expensive kind of experiments with new routing options.
Well, the Pope still flies Alitalia.
Exactly, that's it.
Let me say something going on. Shall we move on to a story from Corriere della Sera, all about electronic cigarettes?
Yeah, that's right. And today, of course, all e-smokers' eyes will be on Brussels, as the EU decides on whether or not to actually ban electronic cigarettes outright, and also a whole raft of other anti-smoking measures, including the banning of the selling of 10 packs and so on. But in Italy, the Corriere della Sera is pointing out that actually the e-cigarette business in Italy, at least, has already virtually collapsed, and that's due to domestic taxation against the e-cigarette. What's surprising is just how how widespread the introduction of e-cigarettes have been, perhaps more so than in other countries, and perhaps that explains why the government there has been so keen to tax it and recoup some of that kind of benefit. 15% of all smokers in Italy are now smoking e-cigarettes.
Which has surely got to be a good thing, though.
Well, it is, but we don't actually know whether it's there's no, I mean, as the EU is kind of deciding, that there's various arguments whether or not of the health risks of the e-cigarettes. And there's also a really confusing picture from the rest of Europe. Greece, the authorities in Greece have banned them outright. They're not allowed. In France, they are allowed only as a medicinal device. In Germany, Belgium and Holland, there's no legislation whatsoever. And I believe that's the case for the EU. For the UK as well. So it's a very confused picture over the electronic cigarettes, and hopefully the EU decisions might clarify things.
And finally, somewhat. David, a story out of La Repubblica.
Yeah, and that's this is another business story from the Italian Association of Builders and Engineers. Good news for Italian engineers that their expertise is in more need than ever abroad. And new markets, surprising markets, are developing. And those are established markets where there are big competitors like the US, Australia and other kind of established first world markets. Italian engineers are doing particularly well, especially in the fields of railways and big industrial plants like drinking water plants and so on. So it's quite a good news story coming from La Repubblica.
And that's all we've got time for. David, thank you very much indeed for coming in. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denis. I mispronounced our producer's name.
Daphne Denny.
And our researcher, Gaia Lutz and Harriet Thorpe. Also our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next after the news, it's The Urbanist. And stay tuned for The Briefing, which is coming up at midday in London and at 7 a.m. in New York City. Chloe Potter and Tighe Enright will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Georgina Godwin.
And from me, Phil Hahn. Have a great day. We've got lots coming up in on Monocle 24, of course, Aperitivo at 1800 hours London time, the Globalist Asia at 2000 hours, and of course the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours as well. Thanks very much for listening. Bye bye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.